When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Happy Halloween, John.
Happy Halloween, Adam.
Happy Halloween, deconstructionist listeners. We have a special. This is special.
This is very special. This is a first for us.
What are we doing here?
So you had this great idea that when we decided we were going to do this episode, you're like, we should do this like at a pub or a bar somewhere. And so we literally, this is plan B. The first bar we went to, they had a trivia night, so that wasn't going to work. So we came to the second place, and we are literally set up at a booth in the middle of a restaurant with people probably staring at us, wondering what we're doing.
This is fantastic.
Yeah.
And to kick it back to you, like, you had a great idea. In the midst of the chaos of our lives right now, you were like, Adam, my favorite holiday is coming.
That's true.
My favorite holiday is coming, and the father of this holiday is the devil.
I guess so, yeah.
And you were like, we should do an episode about the devil. I've done all this research. I've got some guests I want to line up. And like, yeah. life happens.
Yes.
And life happened to us.
And believe it or not, every once in a while, we reach out to a guest and they ignore our emails. So, and that's okay. That's all right.
In all fairness, this guest was very old.
Yes. But would have been amazing. But I had all this research done, and I remember I called you, and I thought, Adam, like, we should still do this episode. We haven't done an episode between the two of us in a while. I have all this great research. It's really interesting stuff that I think would be interesting to other people. We should just record this, and so here we are.
John did so much research.
So many pages of notes.
And there's nothing I like more than when John has, a bee in his bonnet. He's got some juice that he's brewing. And we need to get it out. So, this is a special Halloween episode where John and I go to a bar. You are sitting in a bar with us. And John has got some incredible research. And we are going to talk about the devil.
That's right. While Adam and I drink beer and eat chicken wings.
Yeah.
So,
we are eating the devil's food, drinking the devil's juice, talking about the devil.
These wings are a little hot. So, there's a little fire there. There's a little
fire.
We thought it would be interesting. We've kind of in the past, this is, believe it or not, year three. This is our third Halloween season.
You get out of here.
Yeah, so we have to bring back the thing we did the first year, which is talk about our favorite Halloween movies recently before we get into it.
Crazy.
So I just finished watching on Netflix. I watched House on Haunted Hill.
Oh, my gosh. I'm into it.
It's unbelievable.
It's so good.
Unbelievable. And I'm going to blow your mind off air because I don't want to, because it's still new, and it would be a spoiler alert, and I don't want to do that to people who haven't seen it yet. It is a work of art. It is a drama disguised as a horror movie. It's incredible. But anyway.
It reminds me of Bloodlines meets that really dramatic show on ABC or NBC right now, This Is Us.
Yeah.
Meets Stephen King.
Yes.
And it's so good.
Speaking of, Stephen King tweeted out the other day that he's like, I'm not usually a fan when people remake a book or a movie that had been done previously and take artistic liberty with it. He goes, but in this case, it's absolutely a work of genius.
It's phenomenal. So
you loved it.
Haunted Hill, what are your Halloween movies though?
Of all time, I would say The Exorcist is still my favorite.
Same.
Just because there's that element of realism there that, if true, is the most terrifying thing that I can think of.
Yeah.
I like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
The Matthew McConaughey one from the 70s?
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh.
He was in, like, the crappy sequel with robotic leg.
You're right. That was a sequel.
Which is fantastic for other reasons. But, no, the original one from the 70s with, like, the hippie kids and the van.
Yeah. That's right.
That one's super good. As far as, like, more recent ones, I don't know. Like, I haven't been a big fan of, like, a lot of the recent ones.
Have you seen The Babadook?
Oh, yes, with that exception.
Holy crap.
That one's really good.
Woo!
But you know what I've been doing? So the wife and I have an annual tradition where the month leading up to Halloween, every night we watch a new Halloween movie, and we try to mix up like old ones we've never seen. So I've watched The Reanimator, which is cheese-tastic. But we went through a bunch of these like lesser-known Hitchcock movies, and I've really been enjoying them. A lot of like Jimmy Stewart. And
oh, man.
So, like, Rear Window, which is not as obscure, but Rope, The Man who Knew Too Much.
There you go.
Some really good stuff there. So, anyway.
Yeah, I'm a fan of The Exorcist, The Babadook. My kind of sleeper, like, horror movie hit is Event Horizon.
Oh, that's a good one.
I don't know. It's just creeps the heck out of me, man.
Oh, that's a good one.
It's so creepy.
There's something about, like, the cold emptiness of space.
Oh!
That is just terrifying. Kind of like super deep water. Like, I have this reoccurring nightmare that, like, I fall over the side of a ship in the Arctic.
Seriously?
Yeah. Where, like, it's just dark and gray, and there's just this, huge waves and deep, just dark, dark water.
Ooh.
And, like, that to me is terrifying.
The Shining...
Oh, that's a good one.
Yep. Is a must.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I'm with you, man. It's definitely a fun time of year to just kind of, you know, just get into the spirit, get into it with the kids, have a good time. You have always have a rip-roaring annual Halloween party.
I do.
I mean, ladies and gentlemen, John Williamson, he really knows how to turn the festivities on. You do.
I feel
like a smoke machine,
yes.
And you were playing the movie The Burbs, which we didn't mention already, because it doesn't count as like a horror movie, but Halloween movie.
One of my faves.
The Burbs is number one.
It's just fun.
We could start quoting The Burbs right now, but we might start to lose our listeners.
Yeah.
So,
if you haven't seen it, it's probably Tom Hanks' finest movie.
But this is the Devil's Holiday.
Yes.
It is something that I was not allowed to participate in as a child. Were you allowed to trick or treat? You were ELCA.
Yeah. My parents didn't really care. So, like, which is weird because my parents, my mom probably more so than my dad, would occasionally watch like a horror movie or whatever. But my parents weren't really that into it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they didn't really, like, I had a very. I don't know. They exposed me just enough to the world to the point where it wasn't like absolute just culture shock.
Yeah, like me.
When reality, I remember I got to listen to music that had like occasional profanity in it. You know, like punk rock, you know, and my mom bought me that album. But like it was under the understanding that like you don't repeat those words, but like I get it within the art.
Absolutely.
You know. So yeah.
Halloween was something that, you know, as like Pete Rollins would say, like the prohibition creates the desire, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's probably why I love horror movies.
Yeah.
I think it's a huge part of why I love to go trick-or-treating with my kids.
Yeah.
But try to watch all the Halloween specials.
Yes.
We've been watching all of them. You know, you gotta like find a bootleg website to like stream the Garfield Halloween special.
Dude, I own
it's
a copy.
Amazing. It's amazing.
My favorite.
It's amazing.
My coworkers didn't know what that was.
It's almost too scary for kids.
It's true. They know where you live.
Oh my gosh, dude.
The old man.
When they take the rowboat like across the like the lake to this old house and it's the old man and they're like running around. It's very, very scary, but I love it.
And Binky the Clown.
Yeah, Binky the Clown. So the prohibition creates the desire. And I think there's a whole lot of stuff we can start talking about here, but we promised our listeners some good juice.
Yes, we did.
On the devil. So I'm going to tee you up because you've got all the research. So if you're deconstructing Christian or if you're skeptical or if you were raised fundy and like me, you were not allowed to participate in Halloween, you were not allowed to do certain things, you were like... in a house in some ways like in The Waterboy, Bobby Boucher's mom, everything's getting blamed on the devil.
Right.
And it makes it really hard to engage without smirking or without... There's just... We need more background. Like the episode we did a while back with Richard Beck, reviving old Scratch.
Yeah.
So let's start to talk about the devil. Where do you want to start?
I think the best place to start is at the beginning, right? So, like, one of the big things, and I'm glad you mentioned that. So, like, I think some other good episodes to go back and listen to if you haven't heard them already. Our first season in 2016, we did an episode on the devil with Richard Beck, Dr. Richard Beck, and we did a couple episodes on hell, alternate theories on hell. So I think it'd be cool to go a little bit deeper into the historical aspects of, like, where did the concept of the devil come from?
Yeah.
You know, where does the term come from? Because those of us who grew up in the church, like, you either blame the devil for everything, right? Like, so the evil one, Satan, like, it's his fault, he's attacking me.
Yeah.
Or you were just like, thought it was nonsense, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, any of us who have read specifically the Old Testament know that there's a very different type of figure that shows up in the Old Testament than the New Testament. And so, like, starting to look into that, and I'll put some resources up in the show notes, because I think there's some really interesting books out there. I wanted to know more about, like, I want to know more about the evolution of this figure, Satan or the devil or Beelzebub or Old Scratch or
Lucifer
or whatever.
Yeah.
Where did all these names come from? Why is the character so different between the two testaments, you know, the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, as we call it, and the New Testament? So,
yeah. So quick question. Let me ask you this for myself too, because honestly, I'm sitting here and I haven't been reading the Bible much in the past couple of years. You know, it's kind of letting that one just sit a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Refreshing. Kind of hitting the reset button. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. And, I'm trying to remember, outside of Job,
yes,
and outside of, like, there's a couple little, like, obscure passages, like in Isaiah,
yes,
and Genesis.
Yep.
What else? I mean, it's not a big player. It's not a big character, as far as I can remember.
No,
in the Old
that's
Testament.
True.
Okay,
that's true. And you're exactly right. So the instances where, like, Satan in the Hebrew language. So, like, so there's a couple things. There's history at play here. There's this evolving religion, because at the time, of course, like, we're talking about Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few things at play here. And so, like, the first thing is, like, in the Hebrew Bible, you know, we see these references to Satan or the Satan or the Satan.
The Satan is my theology professor.
Yes.
The Satan. We always made fun of him behind his back.
And so you're like, wait, the Satan?
The Satan.
Or the Satan or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. So, like, wait. You know, so we're used to hearing, you know, capital S-A-T-A-N. You know, a noun, this proper noun. This
is it the
individual.
Accuser?
Yeah. The other translations in Hebrew are to obstruct.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or essentially to block. And so you're like,
yep.
Okay.
Yep, yep.
And so the instances that we see in the Old Testament...
Ooh, we're already getting somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, talk more about that.
So, like, the instances we see the Satan, you know, appear in the Old Testament, specifically, like, we can look at Balaam and his donkey, or his ass, depending on which translation.
Balaam's ass.
Yeah. So that's a great example where the Satan, it was just is an angel or an agent of God who's doing God's bidding, who just blocks his path. It's not Satan, you know, as in a specific person who's doing, evil, you know, and rebelling against God in this story. It's literally God's servant, an angel, doing or blocking the pathway. And so, again, it goes back to that definition, you know, someone who obstructs or someone who blocks.
Now, let me ask you an important question at this point.
Yes.
While I eat this blue
delicious
cheese
celery.
And celery. In this account... And in most of the other accounts, which is why I want to bring this up now, it is assumed, and I think we are reading back into the texts, our primary concern is modern or postmodern scientific, rational, post-enlightened people. And that question is, well, is this a a human-ish or a person type thing? Is this a personal reality, or is it some kind of a name for a force? Is it a name for a reality that has volition and will of some kind?
Yeah.
What are we actually? I think that's one of people's biggest problems with. I don't think there's a lot of people out there that deny the presence of some kind of evil, that it's a force, just like darkness is a force, or whatever. I think where it gets tricky is when that thing becomes personalized. So what are your thoughts on that right now? As we're talking like Old Testament, this thing that stopped Balaam's donkey, and you know, before it was a snake, and it was, you know, all kinds of stuff like that.
That's a great question, and actually, I'm glad you brought up the snake, because we'll get into the story of Adam and Eve and stuff like that later. My sense, at least from the different scholars and the kind of consensus that I was reading through in the various resources, is that in these instances, like the Book of Job, for example, is another great example where you have, you know, Job, you know, you have this Satan again, who's almost acts more as a prosecuting attorney.
Right.
And not with evil intent. And you would expect the story to go, you know, like Job starts to suffer because he's this pious
right.
You know, individual. So you'd expect the story to be like, have the Satan be like, yeah, like, let down your guard, God, and I'll inflict damage on this guy.
I mean, what a book.
But that's not what happens.
What a book.
Yeah, the Satan or the Satan or Satan is not the one who inflicts harm on Job in the story, right? Like, so he's just kind of this person who's like almost like, you know, like a judge or a prosecuting attorney. It's almost like this kind of legal sense of the word.
He's messing with me.
Yeah. So it's interesting, and there's a lot to be said also for the mythology, you know, when it comes to other local religions and other cultures, like Greek culture and stuff like that, you know, that you see other deities within those cultures, like gods of mischief, like Loki and, you know, and things like that. So, you know, to sit here and pretend as if Judaism or Christianity didn't adopt some of those traditions from the surrounding communities and the surrounding traditions is probably naive.
It is. Well, it comes back to that whole, like, did all these ideas fall out of the sky on golden tablets kind of a deal?
Right.
Or is this the evolution of a people group that were real in space and in time and in history that have a history of their own that influenced who they are, just like our own personal histories influence who we are? Like, I know we all think of ourselves as self-contained units of adulthood or whatever, but when you actually come face to face with something that happened in your childhood, you realize very, very quickly that you have been formed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So it's interesting because, like, in researching this, you know, we talk about, like, if you go back to our the series that we did on scripture, you know, a couple years ago with Dr. Timothy Mackey.
We were just babies.
Just starting out. when we were going through scripture, we talked about a lot about the very human impact, the very human influence, the human fingerprints. I think Dr. Mackey talks a lot about that you can see evident in the Bible.
Right.
You know, it's not something that fell from the sky. It's something that, like, human beings wrote.
It blows me away that we have to actually talk about that.
Still.
That blows my mind.
In 2018, we still have to talk about that.
I am not trying to be condescending. It's just shocking to me.
I know.
That some people don't think that there is not just a human element, that people wrote this stuff. Like, God breathed all that stuff. Sure.
Through humans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever. Okay.
Yes.
Moving right along.
I am with you. So you talk, you know, so going back to Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, you know, we see, historically, we see the God of Israel, right? Yahweh.
I like to say Yahweh.
Just breathe it out, you know?
I love it.
Oh, it's good. So we look at the God of the Old Testament, right? The God of the Israelites, Yahweh. And in the beginning, very early Judaism, You know, they weren't even a fully formed monotheistic religion, right? So, like, and this is you can see this, you can read this. There's proof in Genesis. You know, it talks about like Yahweh being the God over all other gods, and
yeah.
You know,
it's not like they didn't think that there were other ideas of God or gods or realities or perspectives or forces or whatever. But yeah, there was like, okay, but this is a step forward. This is more.
Yeah.
This is over. This is eminent. This is whatever, you know.
Right, and the big thing was, and this is the reason that the religion caught on like wildfire, is that a lot of the early comparisons were like, this is why our God is different. Our God is not a warrior God. Our God is not a violent God. Our God, you know, created life, created the universe peacefully, you know. So,
Right.
So, yeah, so one of the big things that we talk about is the fact that many different authors were involved over the course of hundreds of years. There were, you know, various translations and all these different things that impacted the writing of the Bible, right? So, delicious beers just arrived.
This all is very, very important when we're talking about Satan. And,
yes.
You know, I want to be sensitive too, because there are people out there that have had real experiences of evil.
Absolutely.
That it needs to be said that we are not this. No part of this episode is to poke fun.
No.
To, you know, minimize or to make light of the idea of Satan. We are here to almost expand.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, like, I only know like what I think personally, right? And what my research has shown me. I am by no means an expert in this field, but I think it's an interesting conversation to have. I think there are some very interesting things we can look at. And so one of the things that I found interesting in some of the books that I read on the topic is that, so like we know that the Jewish people, the Israelites, like were just constantly invaded and exiled and invaded again.
Oh yeah.
And with that, with you know, being a people that are being invaded and constantly shoved around, you're also inherently influenced by the cultures and the different people who are coming in, right?
Like 100%.
It's just unavoidable. And so one of the things that a lot of scholars noticed is that around the time, you know, the end of the Babylonian exile, so the Babylonians had invaded the Jewish people. Babylonians are defeated by the Persians at some point. And so after the Babylonian exile, the major religion, the one of the biggest religions and most powerful religions in the world at the time, and one of the oldest monotheistic religions on the planet, is this religion called Zoroastrianism.
Zoroastrianism, which is Persian.
Yes. It came out of Iran.
Yep.
And it's this fascinating religion. There are a lot of really good resources out there. I highly recommend people take a look. You can even Google some stuff online, and there's some good resources out there as well.
Nietzsche was really into Zoroastrianism. Well,
really?
Well, his book, Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Oh, yeah.
Was like, you know, he kind of harkened back to like the original.
That's their prophet.
Right.
Yeah. And so so around the time of this vast Persian influence, the Jewish people at the time, they're coming into contact with, you know, Persian traders and merchants and all that sort of thing. And so they're really like connecting with people who are worshiping this monotheistic deity.
Yep.
And you know, of course, they had different names and terminology and that sort of thing. But one of the interesting things at the time that the Jewish scholars were wrestling with was this idea that God, you know, is this all-powerful deity who created the world, and God is all good, and yet there exists, evil exists in the world.
It's a problem.
So how do we reconcile that?
It's a problem.
So like,
I wish Greg Boyd was sitting here right now.
Exactly. So like, God is all good. God, everything that God created is good, and yet evil exists. So then, you know, did God create evil as well?
Oh man, I love thinking about this. I really do.
Oh, it's So interesting.
I had the best conversation today about this in a completely different way.
Really?
Well, just as a quick little, like, you know, anecdote, because this is kind of your show tonight. You did all the research. But the one thing that, so, yeah, God creates everything good. I kind of like to see it as, like, God creates, and what God creates is potential. There's potential. Potential is good. And people that are things that have agency and have volition and have will and have desire can take said potential, and they themselves are potential, and they make choices with that potential.
Yes.
And those choices make something new out of that potential. And that potential is always becoming something else. And it's not really about whether it's pure or not. It's what's going on with it.
Yeah.
Is it tending towards, or is it trending, I should say, towards more and more goodness and life? Or is it trending towards more and more exclusivity, minimalism, self, smallness,
yeah,
narrowness? And that's more like what you would call like evil. But it's all just comes back to potential.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was just, I talked to somebody about this today.
That's fascinating. I've had a very similar conversation with some of my friends just about the nature of evil. Very similar in the way that I have kind of talked about it is, you know, you have free will, and inherent in that free will is the fact that you are faced with choices every day.
Yes.
And you can either make choices that benefit those around you,
mm-hmm,
choices birthed or are grown out of love, or the opposite. And there's always a chain reaction that stems from choices that you make in either direction.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think about the fact that maybe I was not the nicest human being in college to maybe perhaps a young lady. But in all seriousness, you know, like, something that I may have done.
Kavanaugh.
Yeah, no. No, absolutely not. but in all, you know, honestly, like, something that I might have just completely forgot about.
Yeah.
You know, that I thought it was a minor thing.
No,
may
totally,
impact,
man, totally,
that young lady for the rest of her life.
Yeah, you never know.
And so there's this domino effect.
No one is responsible all the time.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, anyway, but yeah, that's a very interesting conversation. So
that's a big part of what we're talking about here.
Absolutely. You know, the nature of evil and how do we explain it? And so, like, the ancient Jews were, like, trying to figure out, like, how do we reconcile this, right? And so at this point in time, you have this Persian influence. You know, you have Zoroastrianism. And so, like, for those of you that don't know anything about Zoroastrianism, this is here are the Cliff's Notes. All right, so it's the oldest monotheistic tradition, founded in ancient Iran approximately 3,500 years ago, and for the first 1,000 years was one of the most powerful religions in the entire world.
Yep,
which is crazy because now it's tiny. Like, there's very few people that actually practice,
right,
it at this point.
Right.
But it was at the time the official religion of Persia from 600 BCE to 650 BCE. They believed in the concept of one god, and they called him Ahura Mazda, or Wise Lord. And they believed that he created the world. They also believed in a Messiah who would come and you know, basically reconcile all things at you know, sort of the end times kind of scenario. They also believed, they're like really into the elements and earth and taking care of the earth. Let's see, what else?
I had a buddy that was a Zoroastrian.
Really?
Yeah, right after college we met. He was from Iran. He was,
wow,
his family is practicing Zoroastrians, and he always said, Adam, it's very simple, and you Christians believe this too.
Yeah.
Good thoughts, good words, good deeds.
Yes.
That's it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And yeah, his name was Rook. He was a really good guy.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's actually funny because I have that written down here.
Really?
Yeah. So, like, those are the three things.
He would say that
things
to me all the time.
Yeah. So they believe, so what Zoroastrianism provided the ancient Jewish people was this dualistic idea of this like yin and yang kind of scenario where like there is good, there is God, the creator, and there is this opposite force that helps to explain away evil. So it's this very dualistic idea.
Yeah.
So one of the interesting things is if you look at like the way that they believe in a hell as well. And so there are a lot of like commonalities there that you can see that at the very least had an influence on the development of like Christian thought, you know, eventually, you know, what would become eventually Christian thought. Yeah, that's funny. Good words, good thoughts, good deeds.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
But Zoroastrianism and people that follow that tradition believe that ultimately human beings are good,
mm-hmm.
and that at the end of the day, good will ultimately triumph over evil.
Yeah.
Sound familiar?
Yeah, absolutely. He would always talk about the, you know, kind of what more like Christians that would consider themselves raised more like moralistic or legalistically.
Yeah.
They basically had utter faith in the fact that even though we all do bad things and there's lots of bad in the world, that mostly if you put on the scales at the end of the day, at the end of everything, that which you did for the good and that which you did for the good would outweigh the bad, and that would produce your pathway to heaven or whatever they called it.
Yeah.
And he would talk about that. It was brilliant. I mean, I loved it. Great exposure.
Really interesting, yeah, because it's not one of the major religions these days that people typically think about.
Right, no, so obviously I found it completely fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is so great!
They're like, what? Go on. So Zoroastrianism helps to solve this issue through their dualistic view on the world. They taught that there was God, and then there was this devil or the evil one.
Right.
Who, the two were in deadly combat with one another, and they both had lesser spirits,
yeah,
you know, who they would use to form their spiritual armies to combat one another.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that there would be one final battle where God would ultimately defeat the devil, destroying him and his demons in a fiery hell.
Amazing.
Isn't that weird?
It's so weird.
Sure, the two had nothing to do with one another.
We're just going to leave that one right there.
Yeah, yeah.
But this hugely impact Jewish people.
Yes.
And no matter when you think certain books were written, it at least impacted redacting, editing, tradition around it, and what we don't just read things, we interpret things. So, you know, the interpretation of a lot of what we take for granted has been influenced by civilizations like Egypt, Babylon, Persia. It's a big deal.
I mean, look at the United States.
We haven't
right
even
now.
Gotten to the Greeks yet, or the Romans.
Yeah, yeah, the Hellenistic period, yeah, and all the influences. So yeah, like that's a great transition. Let's go there. So like, you know, historians are looking at it, and there's this clear Canaanite influence as well, right? Like, so there's this ancient Canaanite myth that describes a revolt in heaven, right? That goes like this. So there's this elderly chief god named El. El is this creator god who created the rest of the Canaanite pantheon. He creates this deity named Aftar, who is the most perfect of his creations. He's endowed with great beauty and wisdom. So he's
like Lucifer.
Genius. Yeah. Interesting, right? And Aftar loves his high status on El's mountain. So he like walks around on the mountain. He walks with the other deities of the pantheon. And eventually, you know, as is inevitable, he becomes a little too big for his britches. And he's like, you know what? I want to sit on this throne. I'm equally as wise as El. And yeah, just as powerful.
Yeah.
And so, of course, he decides, I'm taking over, man.
Right.
I'm taking over this joint. And so he sits on the throne, and he declares open war against El. So El comes in, and it's a beatdown. El takes him out, like, real quick.
Like, no problem.
And he defeats him easily and exiles him from the Holy Mountain and sentences him to the underworld. So another interesting fact,
and this is long preceding Greek mythology, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so, like, you read things like this, and you're like, oh, that sounds vaguely familiar,
right?
And so you start to see these are the stories that these communities would have told one another, mm-hmm. right? And so, like the people at the time would have been very familiar with these other this mythology from these other societies and these other cultures. And so another interesting fact is Aptar was also associated with the planet Venus. And so at the time, like Venus, you know, like shows up in the night sky. It's very bright. And we know now, thanks to science and telescopes, that Venus is not a star. Venus is a planet. But at the time, you know, people commonly mistook Venus for a star constantly.
Sure.
And so one of the things that they were fascinated by was the fact that, like, constellations stay put, right? Venus would, like, change
where are you going, Venus,
or disappear altogether.
Where are you? Oh,
ta-da!
Oh.
And so they were, like, ancient observers, totally fascinated by this, and they developed myths to explain the disappearance of Venus, including within Canaanite mythology. So the story of Aptar was used to explain its behavior. Thus, we have the falling star. Or fallen angel, right? Falling, yeah. So we have, we're starting to see, okay.
I love this. You just go, boy. Just keep going. This is such good juice.
So one of the other names that I think is hilarious, and we don't really use it much anymore, but we use it in, it's like old, like 17, 1800s, like, stories and stuff is the name Beelzebub, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great name.
Yeah.
So where in the world did that crazy name come from, right? That's kind of like Engelbert Humperdinck. Why he picked that name? That's not even that man's given name.
Come on, man.
Why did he pick that as his stage name? I have no idea.
Humperdinck. Humperdinck.
If you guys don't know that's his Princess Bride, shame on you.
Shame. Now, let me just test myself a little bit.
Yeah.
So, in the Greek translations of the New Testament.
Yes.
And then the Latin translations of the Greek translations of the New Testament.
Oh, look at you.
That's where we ended up with Beelzebub.
Yes.
But when we go back to the
Hebrew,
Aramaic and Hebrew.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that was a one for one that we got there.
Man, you're pulling out seminary stuff.
Listen,
right there. Look at that.
It's in there somewhere, dude. Somebody just needs to trigger it.
You guys don't even know. Adam's memory is he always tells me he has a terrible memory, but I don't believe this for a second.
I'm just not in control of my memory. That's what I mean by that. It's back.
That's fair.
It's back there, but
that's
like
fair.
It's like I have this crotchety old dude like in my archives that just gets to it whenever he feels like it. He's like,
mine's like an old hard drive where I have to delete things to make room for new things, and so like I have this revolving door of information.
No, you know the best metaphor for my brain? In Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, when he goes to the wand store,
yes.
And Ollivander has all those boxes of wands, and he's this like senile old wand maker, and he's just like blowing dust off of boxes and handing them to Harry. That's what my memory does to me.
That was the best analogy I have ever heard for someone's memory. I'm like, where's he going with this? Ah, yes.
There it is.
I love it.
So Beelzebub. Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe
so,
not.
So where did this name come from?
Yeah.
Because it appears in the New Testament where the figure is depicted as the prince or ruler of the demons, right? So it's like Lord of the Underworld, Beelzebub. So scholars believe that this is a result of a practice of essentially making fun of other gods' names. This is like, this was a common thing back in the day. So like to belittle another religion, especially if it was a competing religion.
Yeah.
You would essentially like
smack talk.
Yeah, you would kind of tweak the name a little bit to essentially like make fun of them.
Yeah,
like your god is like, you know, a weakling kind of thing. You know,
my last name is Narlock. What do you think people did to me when I was in school? I mean, warlock, dipshit.
That doesn't even rhyme. How dare they? So this was like a common practice, right? So one of the things that we can look at is, you know, you have this Canaanite god, right? And this other religion, this Canaanite god whose name was Baal, right?
Yeah.
So Baal followed by the epithet Prince or Prince Baal.
Yep.
So like the full name would have been Beelzebul. The full name would have been Beelzebul Ars, or Prince of the Underworld.
There you go.
So you have this Canaanite god who's literally just the Prince of the Underworld. There's no negative connotation there necessarily. He's just Prince of the Underworld.
Right.
So at some point, the name is translated in Hebrew to Beelzebub. So it's just tweak just a little bit, the ending there, which basically changes it to mean Lord of the Flies. So
a little smack talking.
A little smack talking, right? So,
well, in Hebrews were huge for plays on words.
Yes.
They did this all the time. Lots and lots of little different plays on words.
Exactly. So you just simply have like one competing religion kind of play with the name a little bit, and it kind of essentially demotes, you know, a god who in their universe and their religion is this powerful god, and you've kind of basically taken him and say, no, he's the janitor who cleans our toilets now.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, he's our bitch.
Yeah. So one of the things I think would be interesting to talk about a little bit, because you can't talk about the devil without talking about hell, is just to touch briefly, because again, if you go back to our hell episodes, we go into this way more in depth, but like this idea that the devil resides in hell, and yet the translations of the translation of the word hell,
oh yeah,
from its from the original words in Aramaic and Greek and Hebrew are actually multiple different words that mean very different things, right? So like,
it's not easy.
No,
it's not clear. It's not one for one. It's not like this has always been, everybody has always known what this meant. This is just the way it is. Hell is hell is hell, and everybody knows what's going on there. So you're telling me, again, just to recap some of the stuff that we've been through over and over again.
Yeah.
It's not that simple.
Right. So you look back at the original languages, so the Old Testament, primarily in Hebrew, you have words like Sheol.
Oh, yeah.
And
or
Sheol,
just the deep.
Yeah.
Or the pit.
There's no fire there.
No.
It literally just is like the land of the dead.
Oh, and I love how even like the psalmist would say, I could go down to Sheol. I could make my bed in Sheol. I could go down to the pit.
Yeah.
And I can't get away from you.
And the original meaning of
meaning
that.
Meaning God. Like, I can't get away from you,
right.
God, even when I'm in quote-unquote hell. What do you do with that?
Right. And the other thing to point out is that, like, there is no division of the good versus evil people.
No.
Everyone went to Sheol.
Right.
So that, I think that's an interesting thing to point out. But somewhere along the lines, the fire, you know, enters into the equation by somewhere around the first century. But again, some other words that we commonly recognize that are translated to the word hell. Gehenna.
Yeah.
Where you live.
Damn,
I'm just kidding.
It. I knew you were going to go there.
That's Gehenna. Sorry.
You know, I try to make theological jokes about that all the time, and they always fail. Always.
You're like, I live in Gehenna.
Bartender checking my ID. Gehenna? Yeah, not the one you're thinking of from Sunday school, buddy. No? No, not, nothing.
Like,
nope. Didn't
no.
go to. Okay, you're an atheist. All right, no problem.
Moving on. Oh man. So like, Gehenna is a great one, I think. And Rohr just did a great sermon on this, by the way.
Oh,
one of his homilies.
I love him.
So he talks about Gehenna, and again, this is an actual physical place.
It was a real place.
Yeah,
yeah.
It still exists.
Yeah, it was there.
So like. It's this place on the outskirts of Jerusalem, and it was a place that they actually used to burn bodies. And so, like, at one point, it was the site of Tophet, where worshippers of the god Molech would sacrifice infant children with fire.
That's not a good look.
No.
No.
So, we can all agree, that's bad.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, so we see, you know, and again, we see it later in the Bible, we see the prophet Jeremiah prophesy against this horrible practice and the people who worship there. But again, not this like eternal destination, right? It's this actual physical earthly location.
Right.
During the Maccabean period, the site was also used to burn the corpses of their enemies.
Yep.
So it's just like this horrible place where, you know, fires raged and they human beings were killed and tortured and burned alive.
Right.
So many of these terms were ended up being translated into the word hell by this rush job we commonly refer to as the King James Version. So, like, you know, this the King James Version is commissioned, and they just kind of took all of these different terms, Gehenna, Sheol, and just kind of mass translated them.
Yeah,
to the word hell.
Right.
So, like, where does all this symbolism and all the, you know, like, this red devil with the horns and the fire and the eternal burning and torment and all that stuff, where does this all come from?
Right.
So, like, how, you know, at what point does the devil, you know, continue to evolve? Because we talked about the Old Testament and the fact that it's more of a an action versus, like, a proper noun.
Yes.
You brought up earlier, and I'm glad you did, the story of Adam and Eve.
Yes.
Because, like, a lot of us, through Sunday school or wherever, always think of the serpent, you know, the tempter.
Right.
As the devil.
Right.
But what's interesting about that is that nowhere in Scripture does it actually confirm that idea.
Well, and so here's, and this is why this is a big thing. So let's pause for a second and gather ourselves around, you know, what we're talking about right now. So, when you are, if you were raised in any way religious or Christian at all, whether it was kind of a half-assed, we're going to use it for guilt and behavior modification to keep you in line as a child, or we're going to full out, like, soak you in this religion. The story of Genesis is so powerful because no matter where you land on that spectrum of Christian participation, no matter where you land on that spectrum, the story of Genesis is kind of teed up as, hey, this book is a supernatural book that tells us about all things. And in the very beginning of this book, there is this devil. There's this snake. There's this thing going on, which makes us then say, well, this must be a very huge part of the world that I live in. This is something big. This is a part of where we are and who we are and what's going on. And so the snake in that book and what we have henceforth done with that story by reading all this stuff and jamming all of this stuff back into it instead of reading it for what it was when it was written, I think is incredibly problematic. So my thoughts on this, it doesn't ever call the snake, the devil. That was a later attribution, which I'm not even saying that that's wrong. I'm not even saying that there's not, like, a link to be made there. I think there absolutely is. But what's really going on there? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so, like, so you have this snake or the serpent or whatever who is tempting, you know, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And what's really interesting is, and this is something that we haven't brought up yet, but really comes into play here, is you have all of these other writings outside of what is considered, you know, the Bible. You have the apocryphal writings, so the Gnostic writings and stuff like that. And so there's a lot more detail that kind of fills in the blanks there in these books that are not an accepted part of the Bible. So, like, the Apocalypse of Moses, the Book of Enoch,
yeah,
you know, books like that, that kind of, like, for the most part, like, I think the general consensus is many of these were written long after the accepted books of the Bible.
The canon was closed.
Yes. No, we are not taking any more submissions, but thank you.
You missed the deadline.
So we have a lot of these other books that that actually kind of fill in more of the blanks and kind of confirm the fact, oh, the serpent was the devil. But you know, like, we're looking at a text that potentially was written 400 years or more after, you know, the initial writings, like, you know, the book of the books of, you know, the different accounts in Genesis and that sort of thing.
Yeah, sure.
Hundreds of years later.
Oh, yeah.
So, so what's interesting is, like, if we look at the accepted texts within the Bible, there is nothing there that confirms that the serpent was actually, in fact, some sort of evil entity. At all.
So what's going on there? This is like proto-psychological stuff, man.
Oh, yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. You know, it kind of, I don't know. Like, I've read some different things on it, and like for me, it always comes down to the fact that human beings, I think, always struggle with our own ego, our own sense of purpose and place in the world, and always desiring more than we need, right?
Like, okay.
That's also a very American thing, I think, probably.
Yeah, I think it's a very human thing, and America has just become a place...
We're really good at it.
...where we have given that a steroid shot and a credit card...
Yeah.
...and no boundaries.
Yeah, and so, I think if you look at the symbolism within the story of Adam and Eve, you know, it's like this idea that, like, you can eat from the... from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and you can become like God. You know, it's not enough for us to, like, it's never enough, I think, is the key to that story. It's like we were free to roam in this beautiful paradise. Like, we didn't have to work.
Right.
Like, everything was provided. I mean, it's like, I don't know, like somebody handing you the keys to, like, the presidential suite in Las Vegas. I mean, where this thing has like a 40-person hot tub, and like all the food is free, and like, you know, food and drinks around the house,
yeah,
and like, and you
much.
Literally don't have to do anything. But then it's like you enjoy that for a little bit, and then you're like, "But I want more." Even though you don't necessarily deserve it.
I'm bored. I want to do something else.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, like,
I want to bend the rules. I want to see what happens.
Yes. And I think there's also an aspect to it, too, where, like, it's kind of the story of humanity, right?
It's the story of progress, if we're going to be honest.
Well, and it's the story of coming of age. Like, think about it in the context of, as a child, like, you're kind of blinded, right, from the reality of the world. And at some point, you become aware, in a sense, of your own nakedness, your own mortality. And so, in a sense, it's almost a story of, you know, becoming an adult, you know, where suddenly, you know, you experience pain on a very real level, and you realize that you are a finite human being, and that eventually, like, you're going to run out of time.
Yeah. So I have a thought, and this is a very heretical thought. Not really. I mean, kind of. But, like, what are we? I mean...
We're the bad boys of Christianity.
We're heretics. We're heretics. So whatever.
But
So the part in Genesis when the deed has been done...
Right.
And, you know, the man and the woman are, you know, at odds now with the Creator because of the serpent. There's a part of that, you know, when you're taught to read this as, you know, a kid or whatever, you know, you just kind of like accept it all, but there's a part, you know, so in Genesis 3, when it's talking about the serpent and, you know, it kind of tees up this whole story about the fruit and the temptation and Eve's going to do it and she gives it to Adam. And then they realize they're naked, and there's this, like, awakening, and, you know, all these kinds of weird things start happening. And then, you know, God calls to them. The God character, like, calls to them, like, "Where are you?" And so to get to my point here, the weird part about this to me is when he talks to the serpent, when God talks to the serpent.
Yeah.
And you got to remember, like, if we're going to use any, like, valid scholarship on this at all.
Yeah.
We don't believe that this book fell out of heaven.
Right.
We don't believe that this just showed up like Joseph Smith and the golden tablets and the spectacles.
Right.
We believe that this had origin. It was around a civilization with civilizations that preceded it.
Right.
And things like, so people wrote this. So I needed to say all that. I know I sound like I'm rambling right now, but I needed to say all that because the point in, like, Genesis 3, when God talks to the serpent and he says, "Cursed are you above all livestock. You will crawl on your belly and eat dust all the days of your life." You're trying to tell me that people that were reading this back then or talking about it, because I think it was probably oral tradition.
Sure, yeah.
Didn't already know that snakes crawled?
Right.
So my point in bringing this up is, if God says something so obvious to this character in this telling of something happened primordially, do you think anybody was like, well, yeah, I'm sure snakes used to just like fly,
right?
Or, you know, or crawl feet around, or yeah. I mean, what was a snake doing in the tree in the first place? Like, how did it get up the tree? Like, come on, guys. Like, if we're really going to pay attention to what's going on here, so what's really going on here? It's symbolism.
Yeah.
It's deep, sophisticated symbolism. And God's not stupid in this character, in this thing. He's like, well, you know what? I'm going to make you crawl on your belly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm already doing that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he knows that. So what's really going on there?
Yeah.
This symbol, the snake, this symbol of something else is being enriched with even more symbolism.
Absolutely.
By saying, okay, now anytime you look at the snake, you look at something that is subverting, something that is beneath you, something that is on the ground, something that is close to the dust, which is what you came from. Because in this telling, the dust is what Adam, which means dust, came from. And now the serpent is closer to the dust. And like, it's, you're heading back to where you came from. When you look at the serpent and you look at the decisions you made, I want you to remember that there is a way back to death. There is a way back to where you came from. Like, there's so much symbolism there, and we just get wrapped up around the fact that, like, oh yeah, this is the devil, and it's a serpent.
It's a talking snake.
It's a talking snake.
Yeah.
But my point in bringing all this up is, if you read it literally like that, it's just silly.
And you miss everything.
But when you read it as deeply symbolic things that can speak and then keep speaking, there's so much going on that deals with where we are right now. Like, the snake, the devil, can still be a powerful teaching wake-up call,
yeah,
to what is happening right now in the midst of what we're doing.
I think that's a brilliant point. Like, even if at the end of this we decide, hey, like, I'm not sure if there's a guy, this deity, this evil deity who rules over hell, you know, and
right.
carries a pitchfork, it still can be a very real thing and a very real influence in your life.
Right.
So that's a great point. So, like, one of the things I want to talk about that I think we kind of talked a little bit about during our scripture series is, like, we can't ignore the very real issues with when you're translating ancient texts into other languages.
Right.
And the fact that there aren't like-for-like words.
No.
And, languages like Hebrew and Greek are very nuanced and complex. And so sometimes there aren't English words there. So we've talked about the history a little bit. We've talked about the sociological, historical impact of other societies, other cultures. So one of the things I think that we should talk about, like, what I call, like, fun with translations.
Yeah.
So,
I love it. He's got this in his notes, folks. It literally is bold face underlined, fun with translations.
Fun with translations. Exclamation
point. That's who you're dealing with right now.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Williamson.
So during the Hellenistic period in Palestine, there was a major issue. So their religious texts were all written in Hebrew, but Hebrew was no longer the native language. So what do? So, you know, the scribes and religious scholars still knew it and studied it, but the common person, the average person, you know, that for them the language had begun to die out, which presented a major problem for Jews who wanted access to these sacred texts.
Yeah.
So there's only one thing you can do, and so Alexander the Great pushes for translation of these texts into Greek, the language of the people.
What a sweetheart.
What a sweetheart. What a good move,
I mean,
right?
He's such a nice guy.
So, yes. Absolutely. Google that. Yeah. So
I love it when Colin played him. Colin something or other.
Oh, Farrell?
Yeah, no. Is it Colin Farrell?
Farrell?
Yeah, I was thinking Will Farrell.
Not Colin a good Farrell. Movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We dyed his hair blonde?
It was so bad.
It was very bad. Yes. Don't see that movie.
Don't watch that.
Watch his other movies, just not that one.
Watch The Exorcist.
Yes.
Don't watch Alexander the Great.
So Alexander the Great, around the 3rd century, commissioned this translation, which inherently created some issues, one of which was how to translate the word Satan, or the Satan.
Really? Right?
So they chose to translate Satan into the Greek word diabolos, which should sound familiar. And the word diabolos has a much more restricted semantic range than the original term. So we go from one who accuses or opposes to the Greek word diabole, which means specifically a false accusation or slander, and the related substantive version, diabolos, which means false accuser or slanderer.
And not only that, think of the word dia, like diagonal, diabolical. It literally means to divide.
Yeah.
To separate. The question is, to separate what? And I think the answer is yes.
Yes.
Everything.
Correct.
To pull apart. To separate.
So that's a huge change, right? Like,
it's a big deal.
It's a big deal. And so, like, here's our very human fingerprints. We have Greek translators who had to make an interpretive decision, thus adding a negative connotation to the original word. So Hebrew Satan to the Greek diabolos, to the English the devil. See, like, Hebrew Satan, Greek diabolos, to the English devil. So we've gone through three languages now. So that's how we got from Satan to devil. So, more fun facts.
This is not easy, folks.
No. The Christian scholar, who you guys may have heard of, Jerome, who's the guy who's primarily responsible for the Latin translation
Saint
of the Hebrew
Jerome.
Bible. Saint Jerome. In the 4th century, he chose to retain the Hebrew term Satan or Satan.
Did he translate the Vulgate? Was that him?
I think so.
I think so.
I think you're correct. So, he had to translate the Bible into Latin, right?
Yeah,
so,
that's the Vulgate. That's
yeah.
it. That's
yeah,
it.
There you go.
Yeah, boom.
So as he's translating the Bible, he decided to retain the Hebrew term Satan or Satan as if it were a proper name.
Right.
So as opposed to the Satan, it's
right.
become Satan.
It's just Satan.
Capital
hey,
S.
Hey, Satan.
So, like, you look at certain Bible passages, Job 1, and certain other passages within the Old Testament where you have Satan. And yet in other passages, he chose to translate the word into the Latin words adversare or adversarium, meaning adversary. So there we get the term adversary. So we hear that a lot, obviously, in American Christianity, because that's where we're located, but we hear the term adversary is another kind
your
of nickname.
Your adversary, the devil.
The devil.
Prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour.
Exactly. So it's like, we laugh, obviously, but we're like, oh my gosh, here's another instance where, like, okay.
Yeah.
This makes sense.
There's a lot going on here.
So, all right, because there's this whole backstory, right? Like, so, like, we talked to, if you go back to our catalog from, did we do The Exorcist last year?
Yes.
Okay, so Father Gary Thomas, so we asked
I'm
him.
I'm still scared.
I'm very spooked by that. It's a very, very frightening episode we did. But we asked him, we're like, okay, so, like, we have this God who's good.
Yeah.
And like, so, like, how do we... What's the backstory here?
Yeah, Gary.
What's the origin story?
Help us out, Gary.
And so what I'm about to tell you kind of, like, you know, falls in line with what, you know, like, what he recounted to us in our interview, which is that, we have this creation story. So if we look at creation stories, we see many references, obviously, to angels. There's angels all throughout the Bible, right? Plenty of angels. But it is, we see that all of God's creation, you know, throughout the days of creation, you know, all of it was good, right? Quote, good.
Good, 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 good. Very good.
So it doesn't make any sense to have the creation of an evil being as part of the initial creation story. So, like,
no.
So how do we work our way around
what
that?
What do we do with that?
So Jewish scholars use the obscure passage in Genesis. You know where I'm going with this?
Yep.
It talks about these giant people.
The Nephilim.
Yes. So as the story goes,
which in Darren Aronofsky's Noah movie were giant rock creatures.
I never saw that.
It's awesome.
Perhaps I need to go back and watch this.
It's so good. They took some liberties, but they got so much right.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely took some liberties, but there were some things, like the way the oral traditions passed on.
Yeah.
This is not a time for a tangent.
Right.
Please continue.
Russell Crowe. So Jewish scholars use this obscure passage in Genesis talking about these giant people, right? These divine beings, these sons of God. So as the story goes, right, so we have these divine beings, sons of God. They see these beautiful earth women. How could they not? We have beautiful women on earth.
Cue the music.
So they see these beautiful earth women.
Get the Marvin Gaye rocking.
That's right. And they take them as wives, and their offspring are called the Nephilim or Nephilim or however you want to pronounce it. These kind of like half-breed, so again, like, face value, this is a
sounds
very
like Lord of the Rings
weird story.
Yeah.
But then, like, the easiest way to look at this is look at the other cultures, like, during the same time period.
Yeah, where did these ideas come from?
So, yeah, where did these ideas come from? So, originally, these seemingly strange references would have been discussing the concept of demigods.
Right.
Right? So, like, just like Hercules in the Greek tradition or Gilgamesh in Sumerian lore, my favorite, Maui from Moana.
I mean, come
he's
on.
He's a demigod.
You're welcome.
Moana is fantastic. You should see it if you have kids.
Favorite
or even if
Disney
you
movie of all time.
The Rock is amazing.
Amazing.
Go watch it.
And the Moana character is the best female character in all of Disney princess.
Yeah, come on, man. She doesn't need a boyfriend.
She
every
is
other,
badass.
Every
I
other
want
Disney,
my daughter to
yes,
be Moana.
Every other Disney movie up until that point, I believe, if I'm remembering this correctly, like the female lead, like there's always some romantic interest. And this one, she's like, I don't need a boyfriend.
They took a step forward with Frozen.
Yes.
Where they kind of deconstructed the whole thing. So they kind of made fun of the fact that she needed a man.
Right.
And like it ended up being like she just needed like her sister and like the love between her and her sister.
Right.
Moana's they took like, a giant step forward with Moana. They were just like, just forget all that. Let's
yeah,
just tell a great story.
Let's just be a rad girl.
Yeah, rad.
And like
okay,
that's.
Please continue.
Yes. So, like, not uncommon at all within, you know, the different mythologies from, you know, these different societies, you know, like this idea of the demigod. So taken in that context, like the story of the Nephilim or whatever, you know, whatever you want to call them, like, not so weird, right?
Yeah.
So if we look at that, and then we kind of fast forward a little bit, it appears, though, at some point in the story, this is used to explain the original story of evil in the sense that it became the story of demons as fallen angels, kind of mirroring the fall, right? So the fall of the angels would have kind of paralleled the fall of humanity in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
So at some point they kind of took like this mythological demigod, story about demigods, and made it, like all about like these lustful angels who came to Earth and, like, forgot their mission and, like, were lusting after these beautiful Earth women, which I get it.
Hey.
But they kind of flipped the story a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, like, so now we have these quote, fallen angels, right, who are being punished. So, and again, we see more support for this origin story, again, in these additional writings outside of the accepted canon, like the Book of Enoch and the Book of Watchers or Jubilees. So in these texts, things get super duper weird.
Super weird!
Real weird. It's a fun read. It's a fun read.
Do
you
it.
Guys should check, you know, like there, you can get most of these online.
We should make like beach copies, like
yes,
like thick paperback, like small thick paperbacks of like all the books you weren't allowed to read from the Bible yes. for your next beach vacation.
And I'm telling you, because I know we've had a lot of people, and we should do an episode on one day on the Apocrypha. You know,
oh, it'd be so fun.
The Gnostic Gospels. There's a good reason most of those were not included.
Because they're wacky.
Because they're crazy.
They're super nuts. So next time you're at a party, like if you're in college and you're listening to this, and you're at a kegger, and you tell somebody like, yeah, I'm a Christian, oh, have you read the Gnostic Gospels? Please, go read them before that happens, because yes. you'll be like, have you?
Yeah.
They're insane. Like, not saying there's not a lot, you know, you can take away from it. You know, there's always something you can take away from it. But like when people are like, well, you know, they were really choosy about what books they put in. I'm like, yeah, and I'm freaking glad they were.
Yeah. Yeah. Because like, I mean, given there's some, there's like, what is it? The Gospel of Thomas.
Yeah.
Which is the most tame of all of them.
Yes.
And then you get into some that are just like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know, so like, so anyway. That's your homework. Go out and read those. So all these other crazy books that kind of feed into this kind of mythology that's developed, right? And so obviously we don't have time to get into all of that, but it's very interesting to see how some of the now famous features of hell, like things that we commonly associate with the idea of hell,
yeah,
like really kind of show up in books like, you know, or texts like the Book of Judith. So for example, in the Book of Judith, hell is described as this place with fire and weeping and worms, things that don't necessarily show up in the, you know, the accepted scripture. And so like, you know, we start to see where like some of this influence comes from. So like,
it comes from somewhere, John.
It comes from somewhere.
And it didn't fall out of the sky.
It did not fall out of the sky. And I'm really pumped because after this episode comes out, we'll give you a little sneak preview. We're getting into, we're going to revisit our scripture.
Yes, we are.
With a triumphant return of a special guest that we had on 2 years ago, and we get a redo.
One of our very first guests.
We get a redo.
Because we sucked at interviewing back then.
We were terrible at
that. We were so bad at everything.
We get a redo.
Adam Gasm's out the yin yang.
It's going to be great this time, though, I promise. So anyway, so let's talk about Satan within Christianity, specifically. So we're talking about, you know, the evolution of Satan, the devil, and all that stuff through Judaism. So within Christianity, we got to keep in mind that Jesus was born into a Hellenistic society.
Yep.
This is important because a lot of the accounts of his life and work reflect many of the customs and beliefs of Hellenistic Jews at that time.
Totally. The Gospels and the apostles' letters reflect Hellenistic culture.
Absolutely.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, like, I mean, we have to do the work, though.
We have to do the research.
Come on, guys. So, like, without going to every single reference to Satan or the devil within the New Testament, in reading each account, they, for the most part, have precedence in either the Old Testament or in earlier Jewish literature.
Sure.
So Satan, like the Satan, in the story of Balaam and his donkey, seeks to block or stop Christians from going on their journeys.
Yep.
So you can see this type of reference by Paul in his letter to the Thessalonians, where he talks about his desire to travel to Thessalonica to visit the churches, or the church he planted there.
Yeah.
But he was unable to because, again, Satan blocked him and his companions from making the journey. So you see references there. And he also plays the role of the deceiver and tempter in the New Testament, which is kind of a different role, right? So, like, this goes back to our prior discussion on the issues with the translation. So, by this point, though, like, the dualism here is fairly evident, right? Like, you have the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan, clearly delineated good versus evil, even more prevalent within the Gnostic texts, because, again, like, they take it way further.
Yeah.
So, like, everyone's favorite book, when it comes to talking about Satan and hell and all sorts of crazy stuff, what's the craziest book in the Bible?
I mean, Revelation.
Exactly.
Bar none.
That is some good, juicy stuff.
Dude, so have you ever heard the anecdote about John Calvin in Revelation? So John Calvin wrote a commentary on, I think, almost every book of the Bible. He might have missed one or two, but he missed Revelation. And the story goes, when asked, and I'm going to paraphrase now.
Yes.
because he was like in Geneva and he didn't talk like me. I'm like an Evangibro. Name drop, George Benson.
George Benson. You sweet man.
Not really. But I'm like that. So when John Calvin was asked why he never wrote a commentary on Revelation, his answer was, I don't get it.
Dude, that was the case for a lot of...
Oh, yeah.
Luther was like, yeah, I kind of want to throw it in the river.
Yeah, I don't think it's legit.
Yeah. I mean, but it's a good thing to talk about because it's the one piece of apocalyptic literature that exists in the New Testament. Like, there's some examples in the Old Testament, but it's the one
there was like
in the New Testament.
There was like excerpts in the Old Testament.
Right.
I mean, this is like a full-blown acid trip.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, let's talk about some stuff. All right.
We got dragons eating babies and prostitutes and all kinds of lakes of fire and golden cities that look like a cube and like burning Babylon. Yeah, it is. Netflix has got to get their hands on that, man.
Very interesting. And by the way, like, if you want a really good breakdown of the Book of Revelation and in a way that like breaks it down in the sense that it is this warning against empire and this beautiful poetry.
Yeah.
One of the books I highly recommend is by a guy named Marcus Borg.
Oh,
wrote a book
yes.
called Reading the Bible Again for the
yep.
First Time.
Yep.
I think it's the last chapter in that book.
It's so good.
It's unbelievable.
The scholarship is solid.
Ugh.
And guys that you know and love probably are drawing on it. Guys like Brian Zahn, Rob Bell.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, Borg really did a good job with that.
And just died way too early.
Gosh darn it, Marcus.
I know. You couldn't stick around just a little bit longer.
I mean, imagine having him and N.T. Wright on in the same episode. Come on.
I mean, they wrote books together.
I know.
That would have been, I don't want to talk about it. It'll make me sad.
Celebrity death match.
Ugh. So there is another book authored after the Book of Revelation. And again, not one that is accepted in the canon, called The Apocalypse of Peter.
Yeah.
That goes further into the nature of hell. It is some fun light reading, let me tell you.
Whee!
Loan sharks are thrown into a vat of excrement up to their knees, and disobedient children hang beside flesh-eating birds. There's some fun stuff in there, guys.
Hey-o!
So it's this text that really brings home the idea of Satan and his demons being tormentors. So, sorry, I'm just reading my notes, and I just wrote, Lucifer is my favorite metal band. So,
there you
I
go.
Don't know what I meant by that, but I just know it was meant to make me laugh later. So, good job, me. So, all right, so the early Christian theologian Origen, so I know we've talked about him before.
He's kind of in and out of style.
Yeah, so
people are skeptical of old Origen,
and probably rightfully so. In some ways, so he took and transformed ideas from the Book of the Watchers, which is another book that's outside the accepted canon. So we talked earlier about the origin of Satan as having been a result of the Nephilim and fallen angels in the story of Genesis. So old Origen went a different way. So Origen goes to the Book of Job. And takes Jerome's Latin translation of the Bible, and he takes Jerome's term morning star or Lucifer, and identified it as Satan.
Yeah.
So no longer are these references to Canaanite myths, but descriptions of the actual person, Satan himself.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Uh-oh. So Origen story, if you will, goes like this. So basically, Origen came up with this backstory where. His version goes like, so Satan was created along with the angels long before the creation of the physical universe, so before the creation story. All right, so this counteracts the previous Jewish traditions that states that the creation of the angels is on day number two. So Satan and his demons are originally angels who rebel against God, right? So in this version, it's not the lust of these angels for human women, but rather the sin of pride. So again, this harkens back to the story of El, right, and his creation, Aftar. So again, we have like slightly different.
It's all coming together,
right? So again, just some more information, some more influence there in terms of how we view current day, the devil or Satan and that sort of thing. So how do we get to the fact that we've got this red guy? Because like, let's be honest, it's Halloween time. You know, there's you can buy a devil costume at that Halloween spirit store, right? And it's always like red tights. There's some horns. Maybe he has a goatee. He has like the pitchfork. I don't know, hooves.
Yeah,
right. Yeah,
it's always hooves.
So how did we get there? How do we determine what the devil looks like? So one of the main things we need to look at that we haven't talked about yet is art.
Art,
the influence and the impact of art.
100%.
Right? So like the Middle Ages, for you guys out there who are not history nerds,
both literature and painting.
It was a good time.
Yeah.
So we have the Middle Ages. And during this period is where we see the development of the horns, the cloven hooves, a tail, a goatee, the pitchfork. I mean, you know, where Satan really got his superhero costume, right?
You know, I think it's important to remember, too, and we've said this multiple times on the podcast if you've been following us, literacy has really never been a thing that's common and taken for granted until like the last 200-300 years for everyone. Like, just let that sit on you for a second and remember how basically vulnerable, impressionable, and easy to steer people were if the empire were to gain some employed artists to render certain things that they needed rendered. Essentially, you couldn't just, well, just go read it for yourself. Yeah. Not going to happen. You needed pictures.
Right.
Pictures communicated far more. Go back and listen to our episode with John Dominic Crossan on the resurrection and the importance of art to communicate the hope of the resurrection and what that actually meant. Mm.
Thank you.
This is a big deal. Images shape thoughts. John, back to you.
Yes. So again, we have art and we have other societies who are influencing. And so one of the things that is kind of interesting to take a look at is inspiration from ancient Greek mythology, specifically Hermes, the god who leads the dead to the underworld. And Hermes had this son named Pan, right? So like Pan and Hermes both are represented by phallic symbols. devil in medieval literature was the king of sexual temptation.
Well,
so there you go.
It's the downfall of many.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Like, if you look at, and people should, like, Google Pan. Pan is shown with horns, cloven hooves, a tail, and a goatee. In fact, like, in some depictions,
yeah, totally.
It's really hard to tell the two apart.
No, you can't.
And so, like,
I remember thinking that as a kid. I was like, hold on.
Wait a minute here. Who's this guy?
Yeah.
So, like, and sometimes, like, the only time you can tell them apart is because Pan is usually seen depicted with, like, a set of, like, musical pipes.
Right.
What do they call that? A pan flute?
Yeah.
Like, Zamfir, the master of the pan flute?
Boom.
Whoa. That's a reference right there.
Jeez.
Children of the 80s.
You pulled that right out.
I did. You're welcome, children of the 80s. So he's holding these musical pipes, and, of course, the devil has his pitchfork. So interesting that the devil would be seen with, you know, like potentially we could say Poseidon's trident, right?
Power
that he uses to torture his victims in
right.
hell.
Yep.
So like the other interesting
there's a lot
thing
going
that,
on here.
Yeah,
it's a montage, it's a mashup.
Well, let's not downplay the importance and the influence and the impact of different authors throughout history as well. So like Dante's Inferno.
Right.
And Milton's Paradise Lost.
Absolutely.
Had massive impacts on how we see Satan.
William
or Lucifer.
Blake.
Yeah. So we should probably wrap this up.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts to wrap up as well.
Yeah, So what after all this? We just spewed out a ton of information, a ton of history. So kind of my feeling is this. And then I would love to get your feeling, like having me just like regurgitate all this information at you. Because Adam's hearing a lot of this for the first time out of my mouth as well.
I'm loving this. I feel like I'm back in seminary.
So
Professor Williamson.
So, oh God, someday. So what are my personal thoughts, I guess, after kind of consuming all this information sitting out for the last several months, is that we see very real, very human fingerprints throughout all the texts, and that history, as it does with anything, shapes and influences things, much like, you know, geography, right? Like a rock sitting in a river, over time, the river smooths the rough edges of the rock. It changes the surface, the nature of that rock. Like, I think history has much the same effect, and you know, all these influences from these other religions and these other societies and mythology that would have been passed down from generation to generation. Also, I think, obviously, like, there is a huge impact when you're translating something from one very nuanced, complex language into another, and yet into another and another. And so, like, you have that complication. You add that to the equation as well. And then you have, again, like I said, the influence of other religions. You have some additional writings that came later that people picked up on, later literature and later translations and interpretations and art and things of that nature that kind of all influenced.
It's like a mosaic.
Yeah. So I think art and other literature further develops the story, and I think potentially you end up with something that is very different from the original intended idea of Satan or Satan and that sort of thing. And that's not to say that evil doesn't exist in the world and that we still don't wrestle with this idea that, like, if God is good and God is pure love, how can evil exist? But again, I think to kind of go back to what you and I were talking about earlier, I think that we can create all the hell that we want here on Earth. And I think we can summon the devil anytime we want through our actions and through our priorities and through the things that we do and even the things we don't do. Like, now is like a prime time to talk about, like, evil in the world. I feel like, especially in the United States, like, the things that we don't do, like when we don't take care of the poor and we don't care for folks who are from other countries who are in war-torn countries or are trying to survive the crossfire from drug wars, who are trying to seek a better life or just a chance to survive or protect their kids. When we do nothing and we turn a blind eye, that to me is evil. That to me is just as evil as going out and pulling the trigger yourself. I'm done. That's all I got.
Dude. I have so much to say about this, but I just want to, like, almost, instead of, like, just making a bunch of comments, I kind of want to just open a few things up. So, one of the things that we've gone over and over again in this show is that words, ideas, are containers of information. They themselves are not always information. They are containers of information. They carry meaning. And so when we're talking about the idea of the devil, here's where it gets really, really tricky. You instantly have two groups of people. One who want to understand a simplified concept of it in order to just enforce it as, you know, a blanket theological statement and use it to create an understanding of reality that helps them with the narrative that they're trying to get across. And the other group of people that want to just kind of throw it out because we're modern and we're science and, you know, it's just stupid now and all that kind of stuff. I want to pose kind of like a third way. Instead of just like capitulating to that which you've heard all the time in the past and saying, like, well, I don't believe in the devil because, you know, too many problems and, you know, I don't believe in like this being that just like is dancing around or like sitting on my shoulder, like trying to get me to make decisions. But hang on a second. So here's what I think this all comes down to. All the stuff that you said, John, all the wonderful research that you, seriously, wonderful research that you've come, here's the big takeaway for me. Across all cultures and across almost all religions and across almost all times and the amalgamation of all of those things, here we still are as human beings wrestling with the importance of the idea of evil and that which is potentially capable in you and in me and in the people that we are sitting around and in this place, this reality that we can't freaking understand. We know and we are horrified and terrified and afraid of that which might happen.
Yeah.
And we know it might happen. And we need to give it names and we need to give it words because I don't care if it's a person or not. Honestly, I don't even know what that means. Maybe it is. Maybe calling it a person is alluding to a reality that I can't see or understand. I'm going to let that be a mystery. I don't even know. Don't care. Not an argument I'm willing to have. Here's what I do know. If I want to look at the devil, all I need to do is look at me at my worst when I am full of my own ego, when I'm sleep deprived, when I'm hungry, yeah. When I am sick, when things are just wreaking havoc psychologically on me and I want what I want, I need to do no more than look in the mirror and look myself in the eyes and say, there's something more going on here. The one part of scripture that we didn't cover tonight that has always been kind of haunting to me is in the early parts of a couple of the gospels when Jesus gets tempted in the wilderness.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the recent film that came out with Ewan McGregor kind of shows Jesus as this person wrestling psychologically with the weight of suffering and evil and choices and potential and all these kinds of things. And Ewan McGregor plays Satan and Jesus. And I think that was brilliant because is Satan a person? Well, let me make an argument for Satan being a person. Let me go ahead and make an argument for Satan being a person. You're a person. Have you met the worst version of yourself? Do you know what you're capable of? Do you know what you really want in the darkness of your heart? Do you know what you're willing to do to your fellow man to get that? Do you know that the choices that you are willing to make? Do you understand the horror that lives just beneath the surface? If all the stars line up correctly, and those things are offered to you in that moment, do you know what you're going to do when those things happen? Because that's what the whole temptation in the wilderness is all about to me. Hungry, sleep deprived, away from everything. And the pit, the darkness inside of the heart of the human one, the representative of all humanity, comes out. And here we see the devil in clear form. And it is everything that you could be at your worst. Aligning with all the powers of destruction and selfishness and ego.
Yeah.
And so here's why I think all of this is really important. And it doesn't matter to me what the language we use, what the name we used, how we care. Like, the important thing to me about all your research is that over space and time and history and culture, people are all recognizing the same thing. And that evil is real. And whether it's personal or not, it interacts with personality. And we need to wake up to it in whatever way, shape, or form that is. Let's not cartoonize it and throw it out the window and say, like, stupid, we're modern now. And let's not characterize it and cartoon it just to get people to say the sinner's prayer and behavior modify just to get some religious reaction that you're looking for. It's bigger than both of those things. And I think it's a really freaking big deal. So happy Halloween, everybody.
Yeah.
Let's end on a downer like that.
Well, thank you to everyone who has been listening. This is like a little nice bonus episode we were able to do. I'm glad we were able to pull this off. Thank you to, where are we?
101 Beer Kitchen.
101 Beer Kitchen in Columbus, Ohio. Thank you to our server, Cameron.
Cameron.
Who's been the man all night.
He's a good man.
He comes up and he whispers and asks us if we'd like another beer. And he brought me chicken wings. But thank you to everybody who has been listening. Happy Halloween. Check us out at www.thedeconstructionist.com. You can follow us on social media. You can join our Patreon family if you're interested. We have some cool packages there. The big popular one right now is the book club, where we pick books, and every month we mail them out to you. So thank you guys for those of you who have joined within the last couple months, who continue to support us there. It means a great deal to us. Follow us on Spotify. We have a Spotify playlist, so every episode that we do where we have a new original artist and musician who are all trying to make a living as well, we add a song to the playlist by the artist who was featured on that week's episode. So go out and check out their music, support them, follow them on social media, buy their music, and support them. And we'll be back in November with a brand new series on Scripture. We're really excited. We haven't revisited this in a couple years, so we're super excited to get back into that again. We have a new guest who wasn't with us the first time around. We have a revisiting guest who we get to redo, and we're going to have a lot of fun with it. And we've got some really great guests lined up for the end of the year to really finish off 2018 in a really nice way. So thank you guys so much for continuing to follow us. And with that, we've been your hosts. And hopefully if you guys like this, we'll do this again. But we are your hosts. I am John Williamson.
And I am Adam Narlock. Happy Halloween, everybody. Keep deconstructing. Satan is real.